Mars, Cassette 22. "Do you think this takeover of Clark is serious?" Anne asked one night as they were retiring to their halls. "It's hard to say. Sometimes I think it must be a threatening gesture only, because if it's serious, it would be so unintelligent. They must know that Clark is very vulnerable to removal from the scene."
"Cassay and Dow didn't find it that easy to remove."
"No, but..."
Sax didn't want to say that their attempt had been botched, but he was afraid that she would read the comment out of his silence. "We and Da Vinci set up an X-ray laser complex in Arcia Mons caldera, buried behind a rock curtain in the north wall, and if we set it off, the cable will be melted right at about the aerosynchronous point. There isn't a defensive system that could stop it." Anne stared at him. He shrugged. He wasn't personally responsible for Da Vinci's actions, no matter what people thought. "But bringing down the cable," she said and shook her head, "it would kill a lot of people." Sax remembered how Peter had survived the fall of the first cable by jumping out into space, rescued by chance. Perhaps Anne was less likely to write off the lives that would inevitably be lost. "It's true," he said. "It isn't a good solution, but it could be done. And I would think the Terrans know that." "So it may just be a threat."
"Yes."
North of the Oxia Archipelago, they passed McLaughlin Bay, the eastern side of a drowned crater. North of it was Marth Point, and behind it the inlet to Marth Fjord, one of the narrowest and longest fjords of all. It was a matter of constant tacking to sail up it, pushed this way and that by tricky winds, swirling between steep convolute walls. But Sax did it anyway, because it was a pretty fjord, at the bottom of a very deep and narrow outbreak channel, widening as one sailed farther into it. And beyond and above the end of the water, the rock-floored canyon continued inland for as far as one could see, and many kilometers beyond that. He hoped to show Anne that the existence of the fjords didn't necessarily mean the drowning of all the outbreak channels. Ares and Cassay also retained very long canyons above sea level, and Al-Kahira and Ma'adim as well. But he said nothing of this, and Anne made no comment. After the maneuvering in Marth, he sailed them almost directly west. To get out of the Crissy Gulf into the Acidalia region of the North Sea, it was necessary to work around a long arm of land called the Sinai Peninsula, sticking out into the ocean from the west side of Arabia Terra. The strait beyond it connecting Crissy Gulf with the North Sea was 500 kilometers wide, but it would have been 1,500 kilometers wide if it weren't for the Sinai Peninsula. So they sailed west into the wind, day after day, talking or not talking. Many times they came back to what it might mean to be brown. "Perhaps the combination should be called blue," Anne said one evening, looking over the side at the water. "Brown isn't very attractive, and it reeks of compromise. Maybe we should be thinking of something entirely new."
"Maybe we should."
At night, after dinner and some time looking at the stars swimming over the sloppy sea surface, they said good night, and Sax retired to the starboard hull cabin and to the port. And the AI sailed them slowly through the night, dodging the occasional icebergs that began to appear at this latitude, pushed into the gulf from the North Sea. It was quite pleasant. One morning Sax woke early, stirred by a strong swell under the hull, which pitched his narrow bed up and down in a way that his dreaming mind had interpreted as a giant pendulum, swinging them this way and that. He dressed with some difficulty and went above deck, and Anne, standing at the halyards, called out, "It seems the groundswell and the wind chop are in a positive interference pattern."
"Are they?"
He tried to join her and was slammed down into a cockpit seat by a sudden rise of the boat.
"Ah!"
She laughed. He grabbed the cockpit handrail, pulled himself up to her side. He saw immediately what she meant. The wind was strong, perhaps 65 kilometers per hour, and the whine in the boat's minimal rigging was loud and sustained. There were white caps everywhere on the blue sea, and the sound of the wind coursing through all that broken water was very unlike what it would be pouring over rock. There it would be a high, keening shriek. Here, among the trillions of bursting bubbles, it was a deep, solid roar. Every wave was white-capped, and the great hills of the ground swells were obscured by foam flying off the crests and rolling in the troughs. The sky was a dirty, opaque, raw umber, very ominous-looking. The sun a dim old coin, everything else dark, as if in shadow, though there were no clouds. Fines in the air. A dust storm. And now the waves were picking up, so that they spent many long seconds shooting up the side of one, then almost as many shussing down into the trough of the next one. Up and down in a long rhythm. The positive interference Anne had spoken of made some waves doubly big. The water, not foaming, was turning the color of the sky, brownish and dull, dark, though there was still not a cloud to be seen. Only this ominous color of the sky, not the old pink, but more like the dust-choked air of the great storm. The white caps ceased in their area, and the sound of water against the boat grew louder, a slushy rumble. The sea here was coated with frasal ice, or the thicker, elastic layer of ice crystals called nilas. Then the white caps returned, twice as thick as before. Sax climbed down into the cockpit and checked the weather report on the AI. A katabatic wind was pouring down Cassay Vallis and onto Crissy Gulf. A howler, as the Cassay flyers would say. The AI should have warned them. But like many katabatic storms, it had come up in an hour and was still a fairly local phenomenon. Yet strong for all that. The boat was on a roller coaster ride, shimmying under hammer blows of air as it shot up and down on the huge groundswell. To the side, the waves looked like they were being knocked over by the wind, but the boat's skittering flights up and down showed that they underlay the flying foam as big as ever. Overhead, the mast sail had contracted almost to a pole in the shape of an aerodynamic foil. Sax leaned over to check the AI more closely. The volume knob on the beeper was turned all the way down, so perhaps it had tried to warn them after all. A squall at sea. They came up fast. Horizons only 4 kilometers away didn't help matters, and the winds on Mars had never slowed down much in all the years of the thickening. Underfoot, the boat shuddered as it smashed through some invisible fragments of ice. Brash ice, now, it appeared, or the broken pancake ice of a sea surface that had been about to freeze over in the night, difficult to spot in all the flying foam. Occasionally he felt the impact of a larger chunk, bergy bergs, as sailors called them. These had come through the Crissy Strait on a current from the north. Now they were being pushed against the lee shore of the southern side of the Sinai Peninsula, as they were, too, for that matter. They were forced to cover the cockpit with its clear shell, rolling up out of the decking and over to the other side. Under its waterproof cover, they were immediately warmer, which was a comfort. It was going to be a true howler, Cassay Vallis serving as a conduit for an extremely powerful blast of air. The AI listed wind speeds of Santorini Island fluctuating between 180 and 220 kilometers an hour, winds which wouldn't diminish much in speed as they crossed the Gulf. Certainly it was still a very strong wind, 160 kilometers an hour at the masthead. The surface of the water was disintegrating now, crests flattened by gusts, torn apart. The ship was shutting down in response to all that, mast retracting, cockpit covered, hatches battening. Then the sea anchor went out, a tube of material like a windsock dragging underwater upwind of them, slowing their drift to leeward and mitigating the jarring impacts against small icebergs that were becoming more frequent as they all clustered against the lee shore. Now, with the sea anchor in place, it was the brash ice and bergy bergs that were floating downwind faster than they were, and knocking against the windward hull even as the leeward hull still slammed against a thickening ice mass. Both hulls were mostly underwater. In effect, the boat was becoming a kind of submarine, lying at the surface and just under it. The strength of the materials of the boat could sustain any shock that even a howler and a lee shore of icebergs could deliver. Indeed, they could sustain forces several magnitudes stronger. But the weak point, as Sax reflected as he was thrown hard against his seatbelt and shoulder harness, holding grimly to the tiller and his seat back, was their bodies. The catamaran lifted on a swell, dropped with a sickening swoop, crashed to a halt against a big berg, and he slammed breathlessly into the restraints. It seemed they might be in danger of being shaken to death, an unpleasant way to go, as he was beginning to understand. Internal organs damaged by seatbelts. But if they freed themselves, they would be flung around the cockpit, into each other or into something sharp, until something broke or burst. No, it was not a tenable situation. Possibly the restraints he had seen on his bed's frame would be gentler, but the decelerations when the boat struck the ice mass were so abrupt that he doubted being horizontal would help much. "I'm going to see if the AI can get us into Arigato Bay," he shouted in Anne's ear. She nodded that she had heard. He shouted the instruction right into the AI's pickup, and the computer heard and understood, which was good, as it would have been hard to type accurately with the boat soaring and plunging and shuddering as it slammed into the ice. In all that jarring, it wasn't possible to feel the boat's engine, which had been running all along, but a slight change in their angle to the groundswell convinced him that it was pushing harder as the AI tried to get them farther west. Down near the point of the Sinai Peninsula on the southern side, a large inundated crater named Arigato made a round bay. The entrance of the bay was about 60 degrees of the circle of the crater, facing southwest. The wind and waves were both also from the southwest, so the mouth of the bay, quite shallow, as it was a low part of the old crater rim, was bound to be broken water, a difficult crossing, no doubt. But once inside the bay, the groundswell would be cut off by that same rim, and both waves and wind much reduced, especially when they got behind the western cape of the bay. There they would wait out the howler and be on their way again when it was done. In theory, it was an excellent plan, although Sax worried about conditions in the mouth of the bay. The chart showed it was only 10 meters deep, which was certain to cause the groundswells to break. On the other hand, in a boat that became a kind of submarine, and yet drawing less than 2 meters of water for all that, negotiating broken surf might not be much of a problem. Just go with it. The AI appeared to consider his instructions within the realm of the possible, and indeed the boat had pulled in the sea anchor, and with its powerful little engines was making its way across the wind and waves toward the bay, which wasn't visible. Nothing of the lee shore could be seen through the dirty air. So they held to the cockpit railings and waited out the reach, speechless. There was little to say, and the booming howl of the howler made it difficult to communicate. Sax's hands and arms got very tired from holding on, but there was no help for that except to abandon the cockpit and go below and strap himself into his bed, which he did not want to do. Despite the discomfort and the nagging worry about the bay entrance, it was an extraordinary experience to watch the wind pulverize the surface of the water the way it was. A short while later, though the AI indicated it had been 72 minutes, he caught sight of land, a dark ridge over the whitecaps to the lee side of them. Seeing it meant they were probably too close to it, but there ahead it disappeared and reappeared farther west. The entrance to Arigato Bay. The tiller shifted against his knee, and he noted a shift in the boat's direction. For the first time, he could hear the hum of the little engines at the sterns of the two hulls. The jarring against the ice got rougher, and they had to hold on tight. Now the ground swells were getting taller, their crests torn off, but the bulk of every wave remaining, its face surging up as it encountered the sea bottom. And now he could see in the foam rolling over the water ice chunks and larger bergy bits, clear, blue, jade, aquamarine, pitted, rough, glassy. A great deal of ice must have been driven against the lee shore ahead of them. If the bay mouth was choked with ice and waves were breaking over the bar nevertheless, it would be a nasty passage indeed. And yet that looked like what the situation would be. He shouted a question or two at the AI, but its replies were unsatisfactory. It seemed to be saying that the boat could sustain any shocks the situation could inflict, but that the engines couldn't drive it through the pack ice. And, in fact, the ice was thickening rapidly. They seemed in the process of being enveloped by a loose mass of bergy bits driven on shore by the wind from all over the gulf. Their grinding and knocking was now a big component of the overwhelming noise of the storm. Indeed, it looked like it would now be difficult to motor out of the situation, straight offshore into the wind and waves and out to sea. Not that he really wanted to be out there, tossed up and down on waves that were growing ever larger and more unruly. Capsizing would be a very real possibility, but because of the unexpected density of ice inshore, it was beginning to look like getting offshore had been their better option. Now, closed to them. They were in for a hard pummeling. Anne was looking uncomfortable in her restraints, holding to the cockpit rail for dear life, a sight that gave part of Sax's mind satisfaction. She showed no inclination to let go, none at all. In fact, she leaned over so that she could shout in his ear, and he turned his head to listen.
"We can't stay here!" she shouted. "When we tire, the impacts are going to tear us up, like dolls!"
"We can strap ourselves to our beds," Sax shouted.
She frowned doubtfully. And it was true that those restraints might not be any better. He had never tried them out, and there was the problem of getting secured in them by oneself to consider. Amazing how loud the wind was, shrieking wind, roaring water, thunking ice. The waves were growing larger and larger. When the boat rose on their faces, it took them 10 or 12 heart-stopping seconds to shoot to the crests, and now, when they got up there, they saw chunks of ice being thrown clear of the waves, thrown off with the flying foam to crash down into their fellows below, and sometimes into the boat's hulls and decking, and even the clear, thin cockpit shell, with a force they could feel all through their bodies. Sax leaned over to shout again in Anne's ear.
"I believe this is one of those situations in which we are meant to use the lifeboat function."
"Lifeboat?"
Anne said. Sax nodded.
"The boat is its own lifeboat," he shouted. "It flies."
"What do you mean?"
"It flies."
"You're kidding."
"No, it becomes a blimp."
He leaned over and put his mouth right to her ear.
"The hulls and the keels and the bottom of the cockpit empty their ballast. They fill with helium from tanks in the bow, and balloons deploy. They told me about it back in Da Vinci, but I've never seen it. I didn't think we'd be using it."
The boat could also become a submarine, they had said in Da Vinci, quite pleased with themselves at the new craft's versatility. But the ice packing against the lee shore made that option unavailable to them, something that Sax didn't regret. For no particular reason, the idea of going down in the boat didn't appeal to him. Anne pulled back to look at him, amazed at this news.
"Do you know how to fly it?" she shouted.
"No."
Presumably, the AI would take care of that. If they could get it into the air. Just a matter of finding the emergency release, of flicking the right toggles. He pointed at the control panel to mime this thought, then leaned forward to shout in her ear. Her head swung in and banged his nose and mouth hard, and then he was blinking with bright pain, the blood running out of his nose like water from a faucet. Impact just like the two planetesimals. He grinned and split his lip even wider, a painful mistake. He licked and licked, tasting his blood.
"I love you!" he shouted.
She didn't hear him.
"How do we launch it?"
Anne cried. He indicated the control panel again, there beside the AI, the emergency board under a protective bar. If they chose to try and escape by air, however, it would bring about a dangerous moment. Once they were moving at the wind's speed, of course, there would be very little force brought to bear on the boat. They would simply blimp along. But at the moment of liftoff, when they were still nearly stationary, the howler would tear hard at them. They would tumble, probably, and this might disable the balloons enough to cast the boat back into the ice-choked breakers or onto the lee shore. He could see Anne thinking this through herself. Still, whatever happened, it was likely to be preferable to the bone-jarring impacts that continued to rack them. It would be a temporary thing, one way or the other. Anne looked at him, scowled at the sight of him. Presumably, he was a bloody mess.
"Worth a try!" she shouted.
So Sax detached the protection bar from the emergency panel, and with a final look at Anne, their eyes meeting, a gaze with some content he couldn't articulate but which warmed him, he put his fingers on the switches. Hopefully, the altitude control would be obvious when the time came. He wished he had spent more time flying. As the boat rose up the foamy face of each wave, there came a nearly weightless moment at the top, just before the fall down into the next icy trough. In one of these moments, Sax flicked the switches on the panel. The boat fell down the wave back anyway, hit the growlers with its usual jar, then bounced right up and away, lifted, and tilted right over on its lee hull so that they were hanging in their restraints. Balloons entangled, no doubt. The next wave would capsize them, and that would be that. But then the boat was dragging away over ice and water and foam, almost free of contact, rolling them head over heels in their restraints. A wild, tumbling interval, and then the boat righted itself and began to swing back and forth like a big pendulum, side to side, front to back. Oops, then all the way over again, topsy-turvy. Then righted and swinging again. Up, up, up! Thrown this way and that. Hold on! His shoulder harness came free, and his shoulder slammed against Anne's, even though he had been pressed against her. The tiller was bashing his knee. He held on to it. Another crashed together, and he held on to Anne, twisted in his seat and clutched her, and after that they were like Siamese twins, arms around each other's shoulders, in danger at every slam of breaking each other's bones. They looked at each other for a second, faces centimeters apart, blood on both of them from some cut or other, or no, it was probably just from his nose. She looked impassive. Up they shot into the sky. His collarbone hurt, where Anne's forehead or elbow had struck it, but they were flying, up and up in an awkward embrace. And as the boat was accelerated to something nearer the wind speed, the turbulence lessened greatly. The balloons seemed to be connected by rigging to the top of the mast. Then, just when Sax was beginning to hope for some kind of zeppelin-like stability, even to expect it, the boat shot straight up and began its horrible tumbling again. Updraft, no doubt. They were probably over land by now, and it was all too possible they were being sucked up into a thunderhead like a hail ball. On Mars, there were thunderheads 10 kilometers tall, often powered by howlers from far to the south, and balls of hail flew up and down in these thunderheads for a long time. Sometimes, hail the size of cannonballs had come crashing down, devastating crops and even killing people. And if they were pulled up too high, they might die of altitude, like those early balloonists in France. Was it the Montgolfiers themselves it had happened to? Sax couldn't remember. Up and up, tearing through wind and red haze, no chance to see very far. Boom! He jumped and hurt himself against his seatbelt, came down hard. Thunder. Thunder banged around them at what had to be well over 130 decibels. Anne seemed limp against him, and he shifted sideways, reached up awkwardly and twisted her ear, trying to turn her head so he could see her face.
Hey!
He cried, though it sounded to him like a whisper in the roar of the wind.
Sorry,
he said, though he was sure she couldn't hear him. It was too loud to talk. They were spinning again, but without much centrifugal force. The boat was shrieking as the wind pushed it up. Then they dove, and his eardrums hurt to bursting. He wiggled his jaw back and forth, back and forth. Then up again, and they popped, painfully. He wondered how high they would go. Very possibly they would die of thin air. Though maybe the Da Vinci techs had thought to pressurize the cockpit. Who knew? It behooved him to try to understand the boat as blimp, or at least master the altitude adjustment system. not that there was much to be done against the force of such updrafts and downdrafts. Sudden rattle of hail against the cockpit shell. There were small toggles on the emergency panel. In a moment of less violent tumbling, he was able to put his face down near the bar and read the display terminal embedded in it. Altitude. Not obvious. He tried to calculate how high the boat would go before its weight caused it to level off. Hard when he wasn't actually sure of the boat's weight or the amount of helium deployed. Then some kind of turbulence in the storm tossed them again. Up, down, up. Then down for many seconds in a row. Sax's stomach was in his throat, or so it felt. His collarbone was in agony, nose running or bleeding continuously. Then up, gasping for air, too. He wondered again how high they were and whether they were still ascending. But there was nothing to be seen outside the shell of the cockpit, nothing but dust and cloud. He seemed in no danger of fainting. Anne was motionless beside him, and he wanted to tug her ear again to see if she was conscious, but couldn't move his arm. He elbowed her side. She elbowed back. If he had elbowed her as hard as that, he would have to remember to go lighter next time. He tried a very gentle elbowing and felt a less violent prod in return. Perhaps they could resort to Morse code. He had learned it as a boy for no reason at all, and now in his reborn memory he could hear it all, every dit and dot. But perhaps Anne hadn't learned it, and this was no time for lessons. The violent ride went on for so long he couldn't estimate it. An hour? Once the noise lessened to the point where they could shout to each other, which they did just because it could be done, there actually wasn't much to say.
We're in a thunderhead!
Yes! Then she pointed down with one finger. Pink blurs below. And they were descending rapidly, his eardrums aching again, being spit out the bottom of the cloud as hail. Pink, brown, rust, amber, umber. Ah, yes, the surface of the planet, looking not very different than it ever had from the air. Descent. He and Anne had come down in the same landing vehicle, he recalled, the very first time. Now the boat was scudding along under the cloud's bottom in falling hail and rain, but the helium might pull them back up into the cloud. He pushed down a likely toggle on the panel, and the boat began to descend, a pair of small toggles. Manipulating them seemed to dip them forward or raise them up. Altitude adjusters. He pushed them both gently down. They seemed to be descending. After a while, it was clearer below. In fact, they appeared to be over jagged ridges and mesas. That would be the Cydonia Mensa on the mainland of Arabia Terra. Not a good place to land. But the storm continued to carry them along, and soon they were east of Cydonia, out over the flat plains of Arabia. Now they needed to descend soon before they were flung out over the North Sea, which might very well be as wild and ice-filled as Crisae had been. Below lay a patchwork of fields, orchards, irrigation canals and curving streams lined by trees. It had been raining a lot, it looked like. And there was water all over the surface of the land, in ponds, in canals, in little craters, and covering the lower parts of fields. Farmhouses clustered in little villages, only outbuildings in the fields, barns, equipment sheds. Lovely, wet countryside, quite flat. Water everywhere. They were descending, but slowly. Anne's hands were a bluish white in the dim afternoon, and so were his. He pulled himself together, feeling very weary. The landing would be important. He pushed down the adjusters hard. Now they were descending more swiftly. They were being blown over a line of trees, then down rapidly over a broad field. At the far end it was inundated, brown rainwater filling the furrows. Beyond the field stood an orchard, and a water landing would be perfect anyway. But they were moving horizontally quite fast and still perhaps 10 or 15 meters over the field. He shoved the adjusters full forward and saw the underhulls tilt down like diving dolphins, and the boat tilted as well. and then the land came right up at them. Brown water, big splash, white waves winging away to both sides, and they were being dragged through muddy water until the boat skated right into a line of young trees and stopped hard. Down the line of trees, a group of kids and a man were running toward them, their mouths all perfect round O's in their faces. Sax and Anne struggled to a sitting position. Sax opened the cockpit shell. Brown water spilled in over the gunwale. A windy, hazy day in the Arabian countryside. The water pouring in felt distinctly warm. Anne's face was wet, and her hair stood out in stiff tufts as if she had been electrocuted. She smiled a crooked smile. "Nicely done," she said. Part 14. Phoenix Lake. A gunshot, a bell rung, a choir singing counterpoint. The Third Martian Revolution was so complex and nonviolent that it was hard to see it as a revolution at all at the time. More like a shift in an ongoing argument, a change in the tide, a punctuation of equilibrium. The takeover of the elevator was the seed of the crisis. But then a few weeks later, the Terran military came down the cable, and the crisis flowered everywhere at once. On the shore of the North Sea, on a small indentation of the coast of Tempe Terra, a cluster of landers dropped out of the sky, swaying under parachutes or shimmering down on plumes of pale fire. A whole new colony, an unauthorized incursion of immigrants. This particular group was from Kampuchea. Elsewhere on the planet, other landers were descending with settlers from the Philippines, Pakistan, Australia, Japan, Venezuela, New York. The Martians didn't know how to respond. They were a demilitarized society with no idea that something like this could ever happen, with no way to defend themselves. Or so they thought. Once again, it was Maya who pulled them into action, playing the wrist like Frank used to, calling everyone in the Open Mars Coalition and many others besides, orchestrating the general response. "Come on," she said to Nadia. "One more time." And so, through the cities and villages, the word spread, and people went down into the streets or got on trains to Mangala. On the coast of Tempe, the new Kampuchean settlers got out of their landers and went to the little shelters that had been dropped with them, just as the first 100 had 2 centuries before. And out of the hills came people wearing furs and carrying bows and arrows. They had red stone eye teeth, and their hair was tied in topknots. "Here," they said to the settlers who had bunched before one of their shelters. "Let us help you. Put those guns down. We'll show you where you are. You don't need that kind of shelter. It's an old design. That hill you see to the west is Parapelkin Crater. There's already apple and cherry orchards on the apron. You can take what you need. Look, here are the plans for a disc house. That's the best design for this coast. Then you'll need a marina and some fishing boats. If you let us use your harbor, we'll show you where the truffles grow." "Yes, a disc house. See? A Saddlemyr disc house. It's lovely to live out in the open air. You'll see." All branches of the Martian government had met in the assembly hall in Mangala to deal with the crisis. The Free Mars majority in the Senate and the Executive Council and the Global Environmental Court all agreed that the illegal incursion of Terrans was an act of aggression the equivalent of war, which had to be responded to in kind. There were suggestions from the floor of the Senate that asteroids could be directed at Terra as bombs that would be diverted only if the immigrants returned home and the elevator went back to a system of dual supervision. It would only take one strike to have a KT event, and so on. UN diplomats on the scene pointed out that this was a sword that could cut both ways. In these tense days, there came a knock on the door of the assembly hall in Mangala, and in walked Maya Toitovna. She said, "We want to speak." Then she ushered in a crowd waiting outside, pushing them up onto the stage like an impatient sheepdog. First Sax and Anne, walking side by side, then Nadia and Art, Tariki and Nano, Zake and Nazik, Mikhail, Vasily, Ursula and Marina, even Coyote. The ancient Issei come back to haunt the present moment, come back to take the stage and say what they thought. Maya pointed to the room's screens, which showed images of the outside of the building. The group on the stage now extended in an unbroken line through the halls of the building, out onto the big central plaza facing the sea, where some 500,000 people were assembled. The city streets were also stuffed with people, watching screens to see what was happening in the assembly hall. And out in Chalmers Bay, there sailed a fleet of townships like a startling new archipelago, with flags and banners waving from their masts. And in every Martian city, the crowds were out, the screens were on. Everyone could see everyone else. Anne went to the podium and said quietly that the government of Mars in recent years had broken both the law and the spirit of human compassion by forbidding immigration from Earth to Mars. The people of Mars did not want that. They needed a new government. This was a vote of no confidence. The new incursions of Terran settlers were also illegal and unacceptable, but understandable. The government of Mars had broken the law first, and the number of new settlers in these incursions was no greater than the number of legitimate settlers who had been illegally barred from coming by the current government. Mars, Anne said, had to be open to Terran immigration as much as could be, given the physical constraints, for as long as the population surge years might last. The surge years would not last much longer. Their duty now to their descendants was to get through the last of these packed years in peace. Nothing on the table now is worth war. We have seen it, and we know. Then she looked over her shoulder at Sax, who stepped up next to her to the microphones. He said, "Mars has to be protected." The biosphere was new, its carrying capacity limited. It didn't have the physical resources of Earth, and much of its empty land would of physical necessity have to stay empty. Terrans had to understand that and not overwhelm local systems. If they did, Mars would be no use to anyone at all. Clearly, there was a severe population problem on Earth, but Mars alone was not the solution. "The Earth-Mars relationship has to be renegotiated." They began that renegotiation. They asked a UN representative to come up and explain the incursions. They argued and debated and expostulated, and shouted in each other's faces. Out in the outback, locals confronted settlers, and some of them on both sides threatened violence, and others stepped in and started talking, cajoling, scolding, wrangling, negotiating, and shouting in each other's faces. At any point in the process, in 1,000 different places, things could have turned violent. Many people were furious, but cooler heads prevailed. It remained, in most places, at the level of argument. Many feared this couldn't continue. Many didn't believe it possible, but it was happening, and the people in the streets saw it happening. They kept it happening. At some point, after all, the mutation of values has to express itself. And why not here? Why not now? There were very few weapons on the planet, and it was hard to strike someone in the face or stick them with a pitchfork when they were standing there arguing with you. This was the moment of mutation, history in the making, and they could see it right before them in the streets and on the human hillsides and on the screens. History label right there in their hands. And so they seized the moment and wrenched it in a new direction. They talked themselves into it. A new government. A new treaty with Earth. A polycephalous peace. The negotiations would go on for years, like a choir in counterpoint, singing a great fugue. Eventually, that cable was going to come back to haunt us. That's what I said all along. You didn't. You loved the cable. The only complaint you had was that it was too slow. You can get to Earth faster than you can get to Clark, you said. That's true, you can. It's ridiculous. But not the same as saying the cable was going to come back and haunt us, you have to admit. Waiter! Hey, waiter! We'll have tequilas all around and some lime wedges. We were working the socket when they came down. The inner chamber didn't have a chance, but the socket is a big building. I don't know if they had a plan and it didn't work, or if they didn't have a plan at all, but by the time their third car came down, the socket was sealed off, and they were the proud masters of a 37,000-kilometer dead end. It was stupid. It was a nightmare. These foxes kept coming in, and at night only, so that they looked like wolves, only a lot faster. And they went right for the throat. A plague of rabid foxes, man. It was a nightmare. Like 2128 all over again. I don't know if that's true or not, but there they were. Terran police in Sheffield, and when people heard, they all came out into the streets. The streets were packed, really packed. I'm short, and sometimes my face was squished right into people's backs or women's breasts. I heard about it from a neighbor in the next apartment only about 5 minutes after it happened. She had heard from a friend living out near the socket. The response of the people to the takeover of the cable's lower facility was rapid and tumultuous. Those UN stormtroopers didn't know what to make of us. A detachment tried to take over Hart's Plaza, and we just flowed around them, moving out from in front of them, but shoving in at the sides so that it was like a kind of vacuum pull. This snarling, foam-toothed, rabid demon at my throat, it was a fucking nightmare. It took them right out to Rim Park, and these goddamned starship troopers couldn't have moved a centimeter at that point, not without slaughtering thousands of people.
This ends side one of cassette 22. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.